Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
This is a HeadGum Podcast.
Hello, halflings. It's me, Jeremy, here to let you know that what you're listening to right now is actually the shorter version of this episode. That's right. There is an extended cut of this episode. This episode, my interview with Izza, a full 30 minutes longer, I think, somewhere in that neighborhood. It's like 30 plus minutes longer, somewhere in that vicinity. Anyway, it is. There's a whole section where we talk about all sorts of other fun stuff. Reality shows, Glee gets mentioned. It's a blast. It's a hoot and a half. And the only place you can hear it is on the Three Black Halflings Patreon. That's right, it's a stealth Patreon ad. Go check out the Patreon, go sign up, and you can listen to the full version of this episode. That said, I'm going to throw it over to myself, who's then going to throw it over to myself. Over to you, Jeremy. Hello, halflings! It's me, Jeremy Cobb. But Thekla Hutirova calls me the Cobb-back Kid. And I am here to introduce an interview. That's right, it's going to be an interview with me and a very special guest, a person who's been a friend of the show for a long time. But I'm not going to steal my own thunder. I'm going to throw over to me. Take it away, Jeremy. And hello, halflings. It is me, Jeremy Cobb. I just realized this intro makes no sense because we just did an intro that threw to me. So I'm going to... this because we will have recorded an intro that says, now let's listen to Jeremy's interview with Izza.
Just keep going, it's fine.
Daniel, feel free to leave this. Hello, halflings. I am here with a longtime friend of the show. If you've been a longtime listener of this show, you've heard this person performing in multiple APs that we've done. They played Zaveen in Slowdown Showdown. You may have even seen them in the D&D Celebration live stream that we did, and you may have also heard them as Pims in City of the Black Rose. Folks, put your hands together wherever you are. Yes, I mean it. Put your hands together right now for costume and prop designer, once and future TTRPG performer and podcaster, trash TV enjoyer, and my dad, Izza.
Oh my god!
This is the wrong dungeon and the wrong dragon.
Full prince vibe? Woof.
This makes them even more black.
Cake glitches and pitches.
And lands in the cusp of a teaspoon.
Oh no!
On a nat 20.
No!
You think this is just a game?
That's disgusting and I love it.
Yeah. We're about to get into something real big now.
Woo! Yeah! Woo! The crowd goes wild!
Halfling Stadium is erupting. People are tearing off their clothes to reveal tattoos. Those are real tattoos of your face.
Oh my god. Is it like everyone has a piece of it and they formed a human pyramid? And,
yes.
And it makes up my face.
Yes, but these are permanent tattoos that they have all gotten of a small piece of your face. There are a thousandth of your face. And they all fell, thrown themselves onto the ground. And the blimp heading above the stadium right now can see your face just on the field.
I guess that will do as an introduction. Yeah.
And cue fireworks. So Izza, thank you so much for coming. Thank you so much for being here. This has been a long time coming. Izza, please introduce yourself to the people. Tell us your nerdy origin story. How did you get into this business, into all this nerdy silliness and tomfoolery?
Oh my god. I mean, so yes, hello, and thank you for having me on. It's been ages since we talked to each other.
Like, yes.
I'm really excited to be here. Yeah, I mean, I guess my like original nerdy origin story was literally just like, I grew up in the 90s and I was a bit of a tomboy and my cousin was really into like anime and video games and stuff. And he would show me like Pokemon and Final Fantasy and
nice.
Stuff like that.
So early gateway drugs for video games.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Like I remember one time he came over with like a poster with the original 151 Pokemon at the time, and he like rolled it out on the floor and he was like, right, that's Bulbasaur, that's Charmander, that's Squirtle. It was really
cute. Do you have a favorite from the original 151?
Oh my god. Gengar and Flareon and Arcanine.
Yeah, those are some quality choices. Quality choices.
My children.
Yeah, I think I was always really sad that Flareon is just not a very good Pokemon when it comes to battling, because Flareon was my favorite evolution back then.
Same. It's my favorite design from the... I mean, I think all the original evolution designs are amazing, but I mean... The listeners can't see my hair, but look at my hair.
Yeah, the flames.
It's Flareon hair. And yeah, like that kind of design just always appealed to me. I always loved fire Pokemon. And it just looks so floofy and I want to hug it. And it feels like the people that make the game are just like, a Flareon killed my dad. Flareon can't have good stats. Like, Flareon can't have good learn sets.
What I'm saying is, why are you having a fire-type Pokemon where there are no physical fire-type moves, only have high attack, but no good special? Like, what are we doing here?
Especially in the first game before the like physical special split and they're actually being like when specific elements were just assigned to
just special.
A stat, a physical or special stat. So fire was only a special stat at the time. It's like, why? Also, why that one? Why not like Charizard? It just doesn't.
I'm right there with you. Flare Blitz was a saving grace when they finally introduced that. Mm-hmm. But I really think they should have just rejiggered Flareon's stats to make him more special based, because it just makes no. He's floofy. What's he doing hitting people?
It's fluffy. Yeah, it doesn't want to get his fur all.
You know who should have a good physical? Jolteon. I feel like Jolteon should be able to stab people with his spiky fur.
Yeah, and they give it like pin missile and stuff like that, which kind of evokes that. But then pin missile is like a bug attack. Is this all sorts of weird stuff, like holdovers from the original Pokemon games? They were very strangely made games. That's actually one of the things I love doing, is just like deep diving on YouTube about like weird stuff that was programmed into the early Pokemon games that they just like didn't get rid of.
Yeah. Like Missing No and like the weird, did you have the rumor like on your playground that you could get Mew if you used strength and pushed a truck?
Oh, of course. Yeah. Someone's dad worked at Nintendo and saw Mew.
I once met someone who claimed that he had seen the final episode of the Pokemon anime. Now, this was like in 1998 or 1999 when I met this person, but he insisted that he had seen the final episode of the Pokemon anime, and that it consisted of, I think, Pikachu beating Charmander to death with a Pokeball. And like, as well as a number of other Pokemon.
Why is that?
I don't even know. It was he'd so never actually seen Pokemon. I don't think he was allowed to watch it. I think he'd seen images of Pokemon and then just decided to spin that out to make himself feel cool.
Yeah. Maybe that's a case where the parents had been like, Pokemon is intrinsically violent.
That was 100%. Yeah, it was 100% that he wasn't allowed to watch it because they thought it was
an ending that Pokemon would have had.
100%. But so from there, you were into Final Fantasy, you were into Pokemon, and how did things sort of progress from there?
Yeah, like at the time, I remember like we used to watch like the X-Men 90s cartoon and like the Batman series, and then like Justice League and those kind of shows came out, and I was really into them. Got more into like anime and stuff at the time.
What were some of your favorite animes?
And just like always maintained nerdy interests and stuff. I mean, I haven't really watched much anime in a really long time. I'm talking about when I was like 13, so please don't judge me. But I was really into like Dot Hack and Samurai Champloo,
some old school
and FLCL and stuff like that.
Yeah, it's all good. My favorite for a long time.
My brother's the DBZ.
A lot of DBZ does not hold up, especially when it comes to the pacing. Just really, there's only so long you can scream.
My main memory of DBZ was like they would spend hours upon hours, well, what it felt like hours upon hours, 16 minutes or something, screaming and staring at each other and growing bigger muscles. And then it would be like, what happens next? Find out next time on Dragon Ball Z. And I was like, but they did nothing. That's
frankly extremely accurate. That is extremely accurate. I did, I think I looked at the math, and when Frieza told Goku that the planet was going to blow up in 5 minutes, I think it was something like 10 episodes before it actually blew up. It may have even been more, but he's like, in 5 minutes, this planet will explode. And then hours of screen time.
Too, yeah. And it's like, it's been like 3 hours.
It's absurd. But yeah, so from there, anime, cartoons, and then eventually...
Yeah, I haven't... So I didn't actually get into tabletop gaming for a really long time. In fact, like some of the things that are my sort of, I guess you could argue like my main nerdy interests right now are things I didn't get into for like until fairly recently, like Star Trek and tabletop games and stuff. And
yeah,
I love Star Trek and there's so much of it right now. We're so lucky. Last night I literally was doing like a Strange New World season 2 podcast.
Do you like,
for like 4 hours talking about it?
Yeah, I was going to say I haven't watched the
new
series.
This could become part 2 of that.
Several of the movies, both the older and the newer, and then I watched several episodes of the original series actually, which I'd always heard was dumb. But I was watching it, I was like, this is good. I actually think this is a really good show. I can see why people liked this so much. I was a fan. What, obviously it's very different from like the newer Star Trek stuff. What, would you say, like, what is your favorite current Star Trek property that's out?
So of the live action shows, Strange New Worlds is my favorite, definitely. Mm-hmm.
What about it would you say you like so much?
So it has this really good balance of, hearkening back to the original series in particular ways, both with like the characters and their, like literally just like the cast of who the characters are. Like something that show seems to do very well is take characters who were maybe like underwritten or underserved or written out of the original series and then giving them a new life in this series and making them much more developed characters like Dr. Mbenga and Nurse Chapel. And even Uhura, who obviously was a main character in the original series, she was still not like particularly developed. She was basically a side character. And
she's most notable, I think, for the kiss at this point.
Yeah, yeah. But in Strange New Worlds, we get to see this sort of origin story for her from like being a young ensign, finding her way in Starfleet and stuff. And then there are characters like Una, who's number one, who was in the original pilot. She was like the second in command under Captain Pike, but was written out of the show for the second pilot because they were told by the network that a woman couldn't be the second in command of the ship, which is because that's the funny thing about Star Trek is like it was very progressive for its time at every time it's been around, but it also has these other aspects to it that are not so progressive and that are actually even to us, especially nowadays, we kind of go like, "Ooh, that's not great, lads."
Yeah.
You know, like the brown face and the saying women can't be on the bridge and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. And then even just the depictions of a lot of, I think, the women in the original series, especially like Uhura, like you said, she's a major character, but there's very little development given to her as a person.
Yeah. And there's a lot of misogyny in a lot of Star Trek. Like, I'll definitely like attest to that. But yeah, like something that's what I like about Strange New Worlds is it's taking these usually marginalized, diverse characters who were, for whatever reason, not really in the show or written out of the show or were quite underdeveloped and giving them more and developing them more and giving them a new life. And then on like a visual level, it has this really cool like production and costume and hair and makeup design where it feels like they are kind of doing this like retro 60s style but in a modern way.
That's cool.
And it works really well.
So this is set
and they also do very cool experimental episodes. Like they did a musical episode this season, so of course
a musical episode. Does the singing factor into the plot or is it just that they're singing?
Yeah, it's a diegetic musical piece, and it's this like, you know, we found an anomaly that makes us all sing as an excuse to have everyone singing. Yeah. But they're also like, because it's Star Trek, they're trying to investigate the anomaly at the same time.
That sounds like a lot of fun.
And they had some really good singers in the cast. Yeah, it's a good show. And I have criticisms of it, as if you ever listen to this 4-hour, 5-hour
What's the name of the show?
Podcast, you'll find out.
What's the name of the show? the name of the podcast.
It was on the Kneel Before Pod podcast. I'm not sure when that episode's going to come out, but I will be sharing it on.
Stay tuned, everybody.
We discussed at length my issues with like the depiction of Spock as a mixed race analogy, and issues with like depictions of the Klingons, how they brought back some of the makeup from like the TNG era, and it basically involves having actors in brown face again, and some of those kinds of issues, which are very present. But then also, you know, the things we liked about the show as well.
So, Strange New Worlds is set during the time of the original series, or before the original series, I guess?
It's essentially a prequel to the original series. So, that's my favorite of the live action current shows. And then the animated shows, actually, Lower Decks and Prodigy, I think.
Yeah, I've heard
amazing.
They're really good.
It's kind of hard for me to pick a favorite among those three. They're really, really good.
Didn't they bring some of the characters from Lower Decks into one of the shows recently? Like live action?
Yeah, that was Strange New Worlds. They had a crossover episode with Lower Decks. And so two of the voice actors appeared as themselves in live action in the episode. That was also really
I remember seeing photos and be like, oh, that's nice. Like, I'm very tangential to all of the Star Trek stuff. I just observe it from a distance. And so whenever something bubbles up, I'm like, oh, that's cool. Good for you guys.
That's neat.
Well, how did you get into TTRPGs in the first place? Because you said that you kind of got into that a lot more recently.
Oh, yeah, that thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, let's loop back around to that. So I guess I'd always, because I was someone who played video games and enjoyed like fantasy and sci-fi, I'd always just kind of been on the periphery aware of TTRPGs. And I had a few, I guess, like false starts where there was one time... me and a couple of friends tried to play some D&D together, like way back when I was like in year 7 in secondary school or something. But just like didn't have a very good experience. Like one of the older girls we knew at the school was DMing, and she was a bit gatekeepy about the game, and I didn't really have a good experience. And that was just kind of a trend where I would like try it out one time and just found people to be quite prohibitive and gatekeepy about it. And so just kind of got the impression like maybe that space is not for me, which I think is something that a lot of women and POC and women of color can kind of sympathize with. And then, God, I used to play in a game, a D&D game, which became a dungeon quest game with some of my friends. When that would have been like 2016 or 2017 or something, but it was like super casual. None of us really knew the rules, even the DM. Everyone would get drunk or high before playing, and we would like sit on the floor sharing one set of dice between us, rolling them in like an oven tray as our dice tray. It was like the most casual, grotty D&D game.
I mean, a bunch of intoxicated people
fun.
Who don't know the rules playing D&D.
Oh yeah, we never got anything done. Like I think we accomplished finishing like one quest in the entire year we were playing.
That's
for
great.
Obvious reasons. But it was fun. And then just through getting more involved in like the cosplay scene again, because I started cosplaying when I was like 13, and then kind of dipped out of it when I went to uni to do my BA, just because I was so busy all the time and. Everything I was doing was like costume, prop, set design. So I was like, I don't have energy for doing this for fun anymore. And then I kind of got back into that a few years after I graduated. And getting back into cosplay meant I was in the cosplay scene when things like CR blew up and stuff like that. And I did watch it a bit, but I was never like...
Yeah, you were never a critter.
Like super duper into it. But I had a lot of friends who were. But I had a lot of friends who were. And so that just kind of... you know, meant that people would be like, oh, do you want to like try playing a one shot with us and stuff like that? And then, a few of my friends from a convention that I was like an organizer for, we started an ongoing game in 2019, which we still play. Like,
I mean, the fact that it's still going is, I would say, an achievement in and of itself.
initially we were once a week and then we were like, maybe once a month. We're all adults with jobs and very different schedules. But yeah, like that's the kind of thing that just happens in TTRPGs. So, and often people just drop it instead of trying to carry on. So I think it's cool that we still have that going. And yeah, and then I did kind of get into the actual play and more like online scene quite quickly as a result of getting into it through people I knew through the cosplay scene and stuff. So I was involved in an actual play show from like 2019 to 2020.
Okay, that's absolutely fine.
I don't think I'm going to say its name because of the things I'm about to say.
don't look this up.
But it's gone and dead now anyway. But but yeah, basically like... but yeah, so I started doing this actual play and stuff started to happen behind the scenes that I wasn't like completely comfortable with as being one of only two people of color involved in the show, and started bringing things up and trying to kind of discuss it, but it was kind of, you know, batted away and stuff like that. And it basically ended up culminating in,
yeah,
you know, that happens a bunch of times.
Yeah, and it just escalates.
Just gets worse because it's not being dealt with. You know what I mean? Yeah. And so then eventually I decided I needed to like break away from that and not be involved in it anymore. Which I honestly think I might have not wanted to hang around in the TTRPG scene anymore if it wasn't for the fact that kind of as I was realizing I wasn't comfortable with this stuff, I found groups of people who were more like just groups of people of color in the TTRPG scene where I could like learn more about the issues surrounding like POC and race in TTRPGs and kind of like figure out and quantify like exactly because it was partly like things that were happening to me, but it was also partly things that were happening in the game. So it was hard. It was hard to kind of like separate those two things and kind of figure all of that out. But yeah, finding groups like Asians Represent and the group I used to stream with during like the early part of the pandemic, which was No Initiative. We're no longer like streaming together, but just because everyone like was busy. Like finding those groups of people where I really like hit it off with people, and eventually like you guys at Three Black Halflings as well, and other just
like
other people in the community who like sort of understood those experiences and were sympathetic to them. Yeah, like Drac, who's how I think we got introduced as well. Like I think if that hadn't aligned at that exact time, I think I might have just been like, well, once again, I guess this is not for me, and I'm not welcome here. But I'm very glad that I did stick around because I've made like a lot of amazing friends through TTRPGs. I've gotten work through TTRPGs, both in actual TTRPG kind of stuff, as well as like adjacent stuff, like making costumes related to it and stuff like that. So it's created like opportunities for me. I even met my current partner through like streaming D&D and Quest together during the pandemic. So I owe a lot to it, and I'm glad.
I'm really glad too. But I think you're the experience you're describing there of trying it once and then encountering a situation that's like, and even trying it like more than once and ending up in situations that are just people. It's just really unpleasant. Just really unpleasant situations for any number of reasons. Whether it's just a jerk of a GM or whether it's like full on isms and ogenies and so forth, where it's just like this is. You know, it's actively hostile. It's like the environment is hostile. Even if in some cases the people themselves are not even consciously being hostile, the fact that they work to create an environment that ends up being very inhospitable and oftentimes are refusing to change the way that they do. Like, I don't know if you've seen on Twitter the discourse over safety tools has flared up again.
Again, it's like clockwork every six months, right?
Yeah. And it just seems so like it the people who are upset about it seem to completely be missing the point of why it was brought up in the first place. And why it was brought up in the first place are exactly the kinds of things you're talking about, where it's to give people the opportunity to say what they are and are not comfortable with in a game, and give them mechanisms by which to flag up things that come up during the game that they're uncomfortable with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the current thing, I've been very busy with, you know, moving cities and finishing an MA and stuff. So I'm not as connected in as I was months ago. But from what I remember, like the current thing is someone complaining that in some official adventure, they sort of added in a box being like, ask for player consent before having them undergo this sort of permanent physical transformation type thing, which for me personally, like, I'm someone who I do not like my character being forced to undergo a permanent physical transformation without me having come up with the idea or agreed to the idea myself.
Right.
Things like, God, spells like, is it reincarnate in D&D?
Where you
roll on a table and it changes your character's ancestry. Like, I do not like stuff like that. Mm. Especially in a game where the in-game concept of race is so heavily tied to real world concept of race in particular ways. It just makes me really uncomfortable. And even stuff like, you know, monsters that can force characters to age and stuff like that.
Right,
if
like
that's
ghosts.
A permanent effect, I'm not into that kind of thing as well. Very strongly. So like, I'm all for putting a box being like, hey, before you make a character do this, like, make sure the player is aware of the consequences and see if they're actually comfortable with it. I think that's fine. And the other thing is, it was optional.
Yeah.
You don't have to do that. You don't have to. I would prefer that DMs do it in a game with me.
Yep.
But you don't have to. No one's forcing your hand here.
I think one person seemed to be upset that the box said it is required that you do this. But Wizards of the Coast is not going to be in your house. Like, you can, if you don't want to talk to your players ahead of time. I mean, I don't know why you wouldn't, but sure, fine. If you don't want to, I guess, you cannot. But like, it's like, not every single person is going to have an issue with it. But enough people do that it is worth asking up front, because that's not something that's going to come up in every single game. Something like true polymorph or reincarnate or any sort of aging effects, which is basically, I think it's basically just ghosts and maybe like a spell. Like, I think one of the Dunamancy spells can age you or something like that.
It can, I think the effects are temporary.
Because
I've had someone use that in a game once, but I think we established that the effect was temporary, so it was okay.
I had a character once get turned, he was like a 13-year-old boy who got turned into a full 30-something-year-old man, and I just thought it was funny, and he just started turning into like a dad type, so he's got like a, he's got, in Britain, a bum bag, in America, a fanny pack, going around being like, all right, everybody, did everybody go to the bathroom? Now, before we leave, like, I want to make sure I got here, I got a whole schedule worked out for us. It was, he turned into that, and much to the
doesn't know why, but suddenly he's making dad jokes all the time.
Exactly. It's like, the way I did it was that his brain just fabricated something of like a life and circumstances to explain why he's suddenly this old, but he still feels like there was a weird period that's just a blur. There's like a 20-something year period that he's just like, I don't know what happened. It feels kind of weird. I feel like I lost something, but you know what? I'm here now.
Don't know why, but the last thing I remember is being like 13 and then I'm just here now.
Yeah, weirdly, in the exact same place. Like, deja vu, right?
Do I live here?
Yeah, but there's a lot of people who would not be comfortable with that. Maybe their character being youthful is a big part of the character, or they're just like, don't change what my character is. I made it for this way for a reason.
Like for me, like, as someone who is in the visual design world, like, the way my character looks is very integral to who they are. For me, like, I will often like draw and design my character and stuff like that.
You did for Zaveen.
And with some characters I did. Oh, I love Zaveen.
Yeah.
and also there are some of my characters where the age that they are at the start of the campaign is kind of important to them. Like, I have one character who it was quite important that she was 18 and she was supposed to be this kind of like young sort of like teenage prodigy wizard type. So to just randomly age her up would like really drastically affect her backstory and like the kind of story I wanted to explore with her and stuff like that. But some people don't really care. They're like, here's my fighter Bob, he's just a guy. And I was like, that's completely valid too.
I will say, there's a character in Unsleeping City Chapter 2 on Dimension 20 who gets aged up by, I think, 20 years. And it's one of the funniest things that's ever happened on that show. But it is absolutely something that you need to talk about with the players ahead of time so everybody's okay with that.
Yeah. And another thing I see people talking about in like YouTube videos and stuff sometimes, which for me, I'm like, oh, that's not something I would be okay with at the table without consent, is sort of cutting off characters' limbs, or, you know, taking out an eye or whatever as you know, they've taken critical damage or nearly died or something like that. And it's supposed to be a kind of lingering effect, which I understand, like, yes, that's something that would happen in in combat, realistically, people would mm-hmm. lose an arm or whatever. But then you're dealing with a character who mm-hmm. now has a disability, which that player might not be prepared to tackle that as a topic, mm-hmm. might not feel comfortable tackling that as a topic. Or if they are someone who has a disability themselves, maybe some disabled people might want to explore that in game, but some of them yeah. might not want to explore that. And especially it depends on the table you're at, whether you feel comfortable exploring that mm-hmm. with the other people around you. So yeah, like having something affect a player to the point where they are now disabled is something where, like, for me, that's like something you need to think yeah. about quite a lot before you bring it into the game, if you are not someone who already is starting the game wanting to
absolutely
handle that as a topic. So yeah, like, I don't think it's something that should just be done flippantly to be like, oh, your character took a critical hit and dropped to zero, so, but they've been brought back up, yeah. but now their arm's been chopped off or whatever.
Yeah. Like, or let people know ahead of time that that's how you intend to engage mm-hmm. with it. Because I think if everybody knows ahead of time, then they can either opt in or opt out
yeah.
Of even just the table. I did I've done two public games in which maimings, I think two, one of in which maimings occurred as part of a mechanic, and one of them was a horror game. And I asked people up front, is it okay with you if this is a part of the game? And then if a maiming does occur, I let them tell me what happened. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't need to be like you lose a whole arm. It could be as simple as you get just a nasty scar or something, you know, something like that, where it's not necessarily debilitating, but it is a very clear mark of what has occurred. Mm-hmm. And in fact, in both cases, when something has happened like that, I've always let the players choose, because I think, again, it feels different if you're the one who chooses, as opposed to if the GM is like, I'm doing this to you.
Yeah, sometimes it can feel like you're being punished just for playing the game, which I don't think disability yeah. should be wielded as a punishment against players.
No.
Yeah.
yeah, and almost none of these actually resulted in any sort of mechanical disability. I think one person, their walking speed got reduced because they lost a foot. And that was about it. But we basically were like, all right, cool, moving on. And it was not a major plot point. But yeah, I completely agree. On to a slightly lighter note. So you mentioned we've mentioned your extensive experience with costuming and cosplaying. How did you get into costuming and cosplay? I have a hypothesis that you may have a bit of a theater background, but I don't know if that's true. This is what I've suspected for a long time. I'm like, she seems like somebody who's been backstage before.
I mean, what yeah, I used to, but before the pandemic hit, that was the main thing I did, was I was a theater designer. So I designed set costume and props for theater and opera and musicals. And also did some work in like indie film and events and stuff like that. Hmm. So yeah, my BA was in design for performance at a drama school.
Called it.
Yeah, you were right. I was like, I feel like I've mentioned this to him and he's just joking, but
maybe you did and I forgot, but I knew that you worked in like theater stuff professionally, but I was like, mm-hmm. I have this image of like you in like college/high school being like backstage. It's just a mental image of being like, yes, I'm one of the people who helped put the costumes together. And I was like, yeah, imaginary teenage Issa, good job. So I see you with like the headset and everything.
I don't think I ever wore a headset. Funnily enough, I wasn't super involved in like drama stuff in secondary school. I was more mm-hmm. thinking I was going towards stuff like fine art and actually philosophy for a while. I thought I might go and study philosophy at university.
Whoa.
I did really enjoy that. I did it at A-level and I really enjoyed it. But yeah, both my parents used to work in theatre. My dad was a director and my mum was an actor. They both do different things now, but they still utilize their drama training in like what they do now. So yeah, I come from a theatre family. I was raised as a theatre kid. I used to go to my dad's rehearsals for his productions of Sweeney Todd and play in the chair, the death chair and stuff like that. which was pretty cool.
Yeah, that sounds sick.
It was very much this thing of like, she's the director's daughter, let her go on the slide first.
That's great.
And yeah, I got into cosplay when I was around 13, 14 was the first time I went. Yeah, 13 was the first time I went to a convention, I think. And then I didn't cosplay because I didn't really know what it was yet. I did kind of make my own costumes and dress up, you know, fancy dress for birthday parties, and everyone else is doing, you know, princesses and superheroes and like bought costumes, and I'm just like, I'm here as Squall from Final Fantasy VIII, and I butchered my mum's leather jacket to make this costume.
Did your mom knew that you did that, or did you know?
It was with permission.
Okay.
It was with permission.
Okay. Because I'm like, oh, did you sneak in there with some scissors? Like, hey, hey.
I think it might have been a fake leather jacket as well. Oh, so it's okay. All right. It's all okay. Yeah. It's all okay. But yeah, and then I went to what was now MCM Comic Con, was then I think just London Expo or something, when I was 13 with some of my friends from secondary school who were also just big nerds as well. And we saw people cosplaying and we were like, oh my God, what's this? This is so exciting. And so I decided the next time I went, I wanted to cosplay as well. So I decided I wanted to cosplay the next time because MCM/London Expo was every 6 months. So twice a year. And my mum actually, her mum was a seamstress. So my mum knew quite a bit about sewing. So she would help me make the costumes and teach me bits of sewing and stuff like that. And we made, oh God, this is like, I was such a little weeb. My first cosplay was from Naruto. Because that was the era. It was Haku from Naruto, the guy with the green
outfit. Okay, yeah. That's
yeah,
great.
Yeah.
How long did it take to make that?
Oh God, I don't even remember. It wasn't a very complicated mm-hmm. costume. We literally just had to make like the trousers and the sort of robe type thing. I can't remember the proper word. I don't think I even wore a wig. I just used my real hair. I went and bought some sandals from Camden Market. And we like sewed using literally the, you know, I don't know if you know this, but there's like this thing with cosplay when new people get into cosplay and they're always drawn to these like cheap satiny mm-hmm. fabrics. And I used those fabrics, like the demon fabrics everybody tells you not to use. Those are what we used. I don't know why my mum was okay with that being someone who actually knew about sewing, but whatever. I think it was because they were cheap and she didn't want to spend a lot of money. That was my first cosplay. And then, you know, eventually I was making fully making mm-hmm. the cosplays myself and stuff like that. Cosplaying from like Final mm-hmm. Fantasy and Kingdom Hearts and Transformers. And it was actually Transformers stuff, which initially I did sort of like humanized designs of the robot characters and then got into making armor through building like mech suits of Transformers characters. And that kind of shift was when I was doing my BA in theater design. So I kind of had the mm-hmm. more knowledge and resources to know like sort of a slightly more proper way to do it. Although funnily enough, I posted on Instagram my first cosplay today because I was kind of doing like a first armor build, mm-hmm. most recent armor build thing. And I used the wrong type of primer and I made the feet way too heavy on this first robot costume. And there are a lot of things I would do very, very differently now. But I still think it was I picked quite a challenging one as my first armor build. It was the Spark Eater from More Than Meets the Eye, the comic series, who's this kind of, Spark Eaters are basically Transformers who are both zombies and vampires, kind of. They're like, he's this kind of decrepit character who's been locked on a spaceship, so all his armor's like broken and rusted, and he's got like wires sticking out and stuff like that, and he kind of wanders around almost as this like zombie-like creature, wants to eat other Transformers' spark, which is like the thing that gives them their life essence.
Wow.
And so yeah, I was like, most complicated design I can find in this comic, that one, let's go.
That sounds as my incredibly first elaborate. That's so cool.
It really
though.
Was. I don't know why I chose to do that. I also did it as like a project for my BA, which my tutors did not understand at all.
at a drama school.
yeah. So in the third year of my BA, we got to do two self-guided projects where we could basically pick whatever we wanted so long as it was relevant enough to the course. So you couldn't do something like completely out there. But it was, you know, a costume building project, so that was within the parameters of what you could do. So I basically they said like, what we advise is to do one thing that's like a little bit out there and weird, and then one thing that's more within the parameters, so that because only one of the marks, whichever is highest, will count against your final grade. So for my safer one, I did like a conceptual stage and costume design project on Stephen Sondheim's Pacific Overtures, because that's just like, you know, set and costume design for a known musical, and was more within their wheelhouse to mark.
Yeah, like, then, it's a lot safer.
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, for the other one, I was like, I want to make a Transformers cosplay. That's so cool. And they were just like, I don't know what to do with this. And I was like, that's fine. I'm just happy.
These utterly baffled theater people. Oh my goodness. Was your theater school like really, were they on the snootier side of things in terms of like, oh yes, the theater. Was it that kind of thing?
They could be, yeah. And to be honest, now that I've done this MA, which wasn't at a drama school, to be fair, but it was within a similar kind of field where you're studying design and making and stuff. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think they could be quite prescriptive about what they considered like good.
Yes.
And, you know, drama schools have a reputation of being quite... what's the word I want to use here?
There's a lot of words
intense.
You can use. Yeah.
Intense. I'm going to use the word intense. Which, you know, my mum went to drama school, so I've heard her stories. And then I went to a drama school, not doing acting, but you know, had a similar experience where I was like, well, this is really intense and people are really intense about this.
It's called a play, folks. It's not called a...
Yeah.
Like, it's like, the
we're not curing cancer here. we're putting on a production of, like, I don't know, what did I do? What productions did I do?
I wasn't there. I don't know.
Productions I worked
at
on.
At my school, what did we do? Most of our plays were written by our course director that we were in. We did in first year, we did like a mini production of Mackinac by Sophie Treadwell, which is pretty cool. Okay. Have you read or seen that one?
No, I've heard the name before.
Yeah, it's a very expressionistic play that is written about it's like based on the first woman who was ever electrocuted, or rather executed in the electric chair.
Yeah, I remember that.
There's a famous photograph where some journalist snuck in like a camera apparatus in the pant leg of their trousers and snapped a photo of her while she was being electrocuted, and that became like a really, really famous photo. But she was executed for I think conspiring to murder her husband or something, and the play is kind of based on that. It presents her as a much more sympathetic character than she was in real life. Uh-huh. Like, the play, it's like society was brutal and terrible and she was just trying to escape, and in real life is like, nah, she was kind of mean, actually. It was pretty messed up.
I mean, I'm not on board with, you know, capital punishment, but
yeah.
yeah she probably did the crime, right?
Yeah, oh yeah, she definitely did it in real life and in the play as well. But again, in the play it was much more understandable because it was like everything in her life is terrible. I get it. But yeah, it's a much more traditional type of type of approach. I feel like if you haven't been to a drama school, it's difficult to realize how intense it is. But the closest, honestly, from people that I've spoken to, the closest analog that I've seen is probably something like the military. It's not as intense as the military, but the mentality of like, if you are injured,
how much you're committing 120%.
Yeah, this is all you do.
Yeah, and injuries. Like
if you're injured, if you're sick, unless you literally can't do it, like the injury better be like you can't walk, or like the sickness is like you have zero voice. It's not your voice is bad. It's you literally can't produce sound. It needs to be extreme.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you basically have to just push through.
Yeah. I am like, speaking of that, I had an experience in my first year. The final project we did in first year was a puppetry show where we both like designed and made the puppets and also like puppeteered and were in the show. And I was cast as like sort of like the second or third lead. So quite a big role in terms of puppeteering and giving voice to the character and stuff. And in one of our performances, we came to London and did some performances here because the third years and graduating MAs, they do a final end of year show in London. And so us first years came along with them and put on our show, like where they were doing their graduating show. And at some point, either during that show or during the pack up, and the building we were in didn't have a lift, so we were like carrying everything up and down the stairs ourselves, I hurt my foot. And I didn't know at the time what had happened. I just knew that we got back on the coach and I was like mildly in pain and not sure what was going on. And through the course of that journey, it got worse and worse and worse, to the point where when we got back to Cardiff, I couldn't put any weight on the foot and couldn't walk off the bus by myself. And so I went to hospital the next day. And so we were doing more performances of that puppetry show back at uni the following week. So the following day I went to hospital. And they thought I might have like fractured or broken something, which I was thinking like, that's so weird, because wouldn't you notice at the moment it happens if something like that happens, which I didn't know because I'd never broken a bone before. And it turned out, like, they x-rayed me and everything. It turned out I'd torn a ligament in my foot, which is still bad. It's not a break, but it's still really bad. Like, ligaments sometimes just like don't heal. Rough. And I was still like limping and not able to walk and had to use a crutch and stuff like that. But they knew about the injury because obviously the tutors had been on the coach with us on the way back, and they'd seen people having to help me like get back into the accommodation afterwards and stuff. So I like rested for the weekend and then like dragged myself in because of, you know, the intense atmosphere of like, I can't not be there kind of thing. But I thought if I went in and talked to them about it, then maybe something could be done. But the attitude was literally like, oh, it's not broken. Oh, cool. Yep. So you can still do the show. And I'm there like on a crutch.
Literally on a crutch.
And to do this show, I had to have one of my hands completely occupied at all times puppeteering this puppet, and ideally both. And we had to, the show took place in multiple rooms, where the audience would be guided around the rooms and the puppet characters would kind of take them there on this journey kind of thing. Very drama school. So we had to like run down corridors to beat the audience to particular rooms. And they were like, yeah, you've torn a ligament in your foot. Yeah, you can still do this. And there's no understudy. And they kind of, you know, at the time I was like 19, 20, not very confident about standing up for myself in those kind of situations. And so you just kind of go along with it because you're like, oh, well, I don't want to inconvenience everybody else. So I'll just try my best and push through. And that shows I have perseverance. And it's like, no, if you're injured, don't, like, you should
don't do this
go
play,
home.
Please. Oh, my goodness.
So, It's intense. And there's this kind of attitude of like, if you're not willing to give it 150% of your entire being and everything, then you're not going to make it in this industry, which some people do still have that attitude. I have come across that attitude, but also there are a lot of people who are just like, no, that's how people burn out. That's how people get injured. That's how people end up with like long running conditions and stuff like that, who are more understanding. So it's not across the board true, but there are people who try to make you feel like it.
And they make it also feel like you're letting everybody down. Like if you can't do a show, you have failed. That's like the way they try to make you feel. I agree with you. I don't think it's nearly as common now as it used to be. I think it used to be just assumed, but you can definitely tell when somebody, like doing APs, I feel like you can definitely tell when somebody has a theater background, and especially if they've done it professionally, because they tend to be like, oh, I'm sick. Well, I'll still do it. Like most of the time, I know, actually that happened, with, a thing that we've recorded a little bit of, with Jasper originally being like, Hey guys, I know I'm sick. We're going to try and power through it. And he was absolutely willing to try and keep going. And we had to be like, no. Bro.
Yeah. We're like, Jasper, no.
No, Jasper,
okay.
Please take some time off. But he was, it's a rough environment. So I wanted to ask also, so we've talked about costuming. We've talked about how you got into performing in APs. I'm curious, when you, as somebody who has performed in a number of different APs, as well as done a heck of a lot of costuming, how do you approach, as an artist or a creator, how do you approach creating and performing a character? And then also I want to know how you approach creating a costume, whether that is a costume that you are designing based on an existing design, whether it's like cosplay or it's something that you're creating whole cloth, pun intended.
I mean, I'm more of an omago, but...
excuse me, whole plate.
Yeah, so with TTRPGs, actually, one of the things I really like about it is that it has that aspect to it where you are creating a character. And that was one of the first things that got me to kind of latch on to the process of being a player was, oh, I get to design a character. And yeah, obviously in a TTRPG, the more relevant thing is the backstory and the mechanics and stuff like that. But for me, I know when I'm creating a character, elements of who they are visually definitely come to the forefront very quickly and help shape their personality as well. And honestly, a lot of the time when I'm making TTRPG characters, it is me just going like, oh, I've always wanted to play around with this kind of aesthetic. And how would that translate into a quest character or a Blades in the Dark character or a D&D character? What class or whatever would that suit? And then kind of build it up from there. Or sometimes I, you know, look at a subclass or something and go like, oh, I really want to try this out mechanically. Okay, who do I think this person is? What do I think they look like? What do I think they wear? And that helps me like build up the character.
That's what you do with Pims, isn't it? Because I think you had Rune Knight before you had the rest of the character.
Yeah, with Pims, she was definitely I want to play a Rune Knight and I think it would be cute and funny if it was a goblin. That was the sort of initial concept. And then we kind of built up around that. And the idea of her being more of like a street urchin type character, bringing in that kind of like punky vibe kind of fell naturally into place, especially because City of the Black Rose had a more leaning towards modern type setting, so it felt like I could bring that in. Although I'm one of those people who I'm like, even if you're doing high fantasy, I'm like, that's just fine for there to be some tech in there. We can do magitech, right? I love some sci-fi in my fantasy.
Yeah, they had guns for like most of the medieval period, or like a good chunk of it. Come on.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And you know, I'm also sort of like, I love it when a world has technology evolving alongside or with magic. Can you tell Final Fantasy VI is one of my favorite games growing up? But yeah, like having played like Final Fantasy VI and Chrono Trigger and games like that, I think it's perfectly reasonable in a world with magic that technology would advance quicker alongside that, either with magic bolstering it or as a kind of competitor to magic. Yeah, like I think it's totally reasonable.
I'm right there with you.
Yeah, I know we've talked about this before, actually, haven't we?
Yeah, we have. Well, because that's City of the Black Rose. The whole thing is like there was a huge magic tech boom, like leading into the events where all similar to what you had in like the 19th century with the Industrial Revolution and the Scientific Revolution, where you have all of these massive breakthroughs being made all around the same times that feed into each other or just essentially transform the way that society functions and thinks. Like, what do you do when people haven't fully figured out how we're gonna, like, you know, child labor still exists. We haven't figured out like, hey everyone, maybe this is bad and we should stop. Like, not, you know, you still have areas where that's allowed, or you still have, you know, you had, I don't think this was a plot point in season one, but the idea of the Augs, these genetically modified, like magically augmented and modified creatures that have been like, you know, maybe it was the technology was developed to enhance like something like Awaken, where it's like, oh, what if we make this dog into a full person? But then you take it further and it's like, but what if the dog also could grow tentacles and could dissolve things? And what if the dog was psychic? And then it's like, well, what happens when the dog gets real upset and wipes out a city block? And then it's like, oh, yeah.
Just because you can.
Exactly.
Doesn't mean
it was absolutely that mentality. And so there had been like a huge sort of an Aug boom prior to the events of the actual show, and they had all been since outlawed. They still, of course, exist. They're out there, but they're officially, you're not allowed to have magically augmented creatures anymore. Officially, quote unquote. But there's at least one game that I've run in that setting where one person is an Aug. They're a full on like bird. They're an actual bird who just thinks he's a Kenku, but he's an actual bird. He's like a combination of, I think, a shrike and like a raven. I can't remember what else. Oh, and a lyrebird. He's like a combination of a shrike, a raven, and a lyrebird. If you're not familiar with a shrike, their nickname is the butcher bird. They will kill small animals and stick them on spikes for later. Like, they have larders.
Oh my god! Like in
yes,
like in, is it
wash yes.
it down?
Yes,
that happens.
That yeah. is a shrike.
Yeah. the yes. deep-seated childhood trauma.
Oh, Watership Down is hardcore. but yeah, but you'll see, like, you can see, like, photos online of other birds, of lizards, of mice on, like, these stretches of thorns. Because the bird's like, yeah, I'll come back and eat it later. So he plays an assassin. He plays, like, a hired assassin who's just a goofy dude. He's just a real goofy, silly God. Dude who just wants a friend, but also has no qualms about murdering people. And his backstory is that he is a literal shrike. Who has grown to enormous size.
Wow.
Yeah. Fun times.
Fun times, yeah. All super happy, Watership Down inspired TTRPG character.
Oh, did you watch Watership Down as a child? Oh my goodness. I can't imagine watching that as a kid.
I was really into the Animals of Farthing Wood. Which my parents always say really surprised them because I loved animals so much. I chose to be a vegetarian when I was like 4 or 5.
Farthing Wood's the bomb.
It was really good, but it was also like kind of horrific, just like Watership Down. And they were like, we were really surprised you loved that show so much.
Yes,
because so many animals
brutal.
Died in it.
I was
in really horrible
ways. On the last episode, I believe that we recorded of this show, I described the hedgehog highway scene because no one else in that call had seen it. Right?
God.
That was the worst one. That was the worst
horrible.
One. Was that hedgehog scene?
Yeah. There are lots of horrible ones, but I think the hedgehog one a lot of people remember as being because of the
and the
really
desperation
fear in it, and it's just like, oh my god, please just
one...
get out. Oh, it's horrible. And then there's also just stuff like the baby foxes dying and stuff like
or
that.
The,
it's just like
one of the pheasants gets shot as well.
Yeah, I think they both end up getting shot by a farmer.
Yeah.
Because they wander onto his land and stuff like that. So for anyone who's watching who's like, what the hell is this show and why were children watching it? It was like a BBC animated
show. Yeah, I read the books
show
as well.
Based on, I think, a series of books that were for children. Yeah, me too. And it had a very like environmentalist slant. It was basically about a group of animals who live in a place called Farthing Wood, and the forest, one day they wake up and the forest is being like paved over with cement and they're basically losing their home. And they decide they have to leave the forest and go to a place they've heard of called like White Deer Park or something. And so it's their journey to get from Farthing Wood to White Deer Park. But obviously they're having to cross like motorways and farmland and lots of them die on the way.
Oh.
And then even when they get to White Deer Park, still characters are getting killed off and stuff like that.
There's like full wars that happen with like other groups of foxes, like the gray foxes and stuff.
Yeah, yeah. They have a very like Romeo and Juliet inspired kind of
100%
storyline.
It's Lion King 2.
Yeah,
it's Lion
King
2 Simba's Pride.
Oh my god. And then they're literally like the only way they will make peace with the gray foxes is that like a bunch of their children get killed and they're like, well, maybe this really was pointless. It's like,
yeah.
You guys.
It is so hardcore. I know it's like a cliche to be like, they don't make them like that anymore. I don't think they'd be allowed to make them like that anymore. I feel like if they tried, parents would get upset.
Yeah, I think there's more regulation on what you're allowed to show children, probably.
Like, this is
genuinely
alarming.
You do get children's shows that are... Yeah, like you do get children's shows that are very complex and deep, I think, now.
Yes.
Like we talked earlier about Star Trek. Like, Star Trek Prodigy is aimed at a younger audience, getting younger people into Star Trek. And so that is like a very obvious thing about the show, but it is still telling like quite complex and deep stories with these characters.
Yeah.
Some of the best written stuff in modern Star Trek, in my opinion. Mm. But you won't have like hedgehogs getting run over by lorries in the middle of the motorway.
You will not have like the violence has been toned down. You'll still have like, I feel like you'll have the emotional impact, but you won't see like that scene, man. It's the shivering and the don't curl up, and the fact that like he went back out there to save, I forget whether it was her or him who went back out to save the other, and the rest of the animals are like, come back, and it's so real.
I'm literally like curling up and cringing thinking about it.
that scene's brutal. Yeah. You know, different,
it's that and like Watership Down.
Yes. I was gonna say in a different way than Watership Down. Watership Down is just nasty.
Yeah, there's like a trio of kind of British animated movies or series that were made for children but are just like haunted everyone. And it's Animals of Farthingwood, Watership Down, and When the Wind Blows, which was like a 1980s or 90s animated film or maybe short film about an old couple in like a nuclear war. It was made during, I think it was made around the Cold War, and sort of like what to do if a nuclear bomb drops and stuff like that. But they do it as a sort of story about an elderly couple dealing with it actually happening to them in the English countryside. We watched it in school.
That sounds so intense. I'd never heard of that one.
It's really That's like the other one in the trio of like traumatizing British
I thought you were going to say Plague Dogs. I've never seen Plague Dogs, but I've heard of it. I don't know if it's British or American.
Honestly, from what
I've heard, it's actually worse than either Watership Down or Farthingwood, because it's like the main plot is about dogs who are part of medical experiments, and it ends on a much more downer note than any of the other ones. But apparently it is like, if you made a movie like that for adults, people would be like, dude, like, why would you do this? So yeah, Plague Dogs is notorious. It's like Watership Down, but worse. From what I could
Yeah. Worse than Watership Down?
Yeah,
worse than bunnies getting
worse.
Run over by trains?
I won't, it's so bad, like, I won't say. I'll tell you off air, but I don't really want to say it, because some parts of it are, like, genuinely alarming. Mm. Actually, there is one part that I can say.
Oh, God, okay.
It's like, after all these dogs have been through, they find appears to be like a friendly guy. I think he's a friendly hunter who's like, oh, dogs, awesome. And one of the dogs runs up and he has like, the guy's holding like his shotgun or something. And the dog tries to jump up to be like, be my friend. Mm. It actually knocks him in such a way that he pulls the trigger and the hunter is no more. And then the dogs are like, oh no. Oh no. That's the one I can say. The one that I can't say is actually worse.
Well, you have to tell me when we're done.
Stuff like that and like Return to Oz. Did you ever see Return to Oz?
No, I don't think so.
Ooh.
I've heard of it. Ooh. Is it like a sort of dark Wizard of Oz type thing?
Yeah, it's a sequel. It's a direct sequel to the first Wizard of Oz that draws a lot more from the actual books in terms of its tone how weird and dark it is. It's not a musical. I'll give like the premise of the movie. I think I may have said this on air before, but I'll give a quick rundown of the premise. So it's post Wizard of Oz. Dorothy's aunt and uncle are very depressed and upset because their farm was destroyed in a tornado. And Dorothy keeps raving about Oz, and they're like, Dorothy, what are you talking about? That doesn't exist. And they start to become genuinely concerned that she won't stop talking about this weird made-up place, or a place that they think is made up. She then starts to see, like, this little blonde girl show up, and, like, in mirrors and stuff. And I don't remember if the girl says anything to her, but she's like, there's a girl! And then at one point she gets like a little key, like an old-fashioned key that says Oz on it. And she's like, look, see? It's real! And Auntie M is like, okay, this is genuinely concerning. We need to do something about this. And they read something about a newfangled treatment called electroshock therapy in the newspaper. And so they take Dorothy into this huge castle, like evil fortress, like asylum. Toto is left at home. Toto chases the car, but can't catch them. And so they drive off to the asylum. Dorothy is like brought in as a patient. She's in this room. The little blonde girl shows up again and just leaves a pumpkin there for no reason. And Dorothy's like, what is going on? And the girl just disappears. That night, there's a huge storm. There's these weird moaning sounds from all around the facility. She's taken and hooked up to this gigantic, terrifying machine. And just as they're about to start performing electroshock therapy, the place is struck by lightning and all the power goes out. And so all the staff runs out to go and try and deal with that. The little blonde girl comes running in. Dorothy is like strapped down. So she has to like, she undoes Dorothy's restraints. She's like, come on, we gotta go. And she's like, what's gonna happen? She's like, that machine's gonna destroy you. And she's like, what? And as they're running through, they hear more of the moaning. And Dorothy's like, what is that? And the little blonde girl's like, it's the other patients, run. And they run out of the building into the storm. At this point, the staff is now chasing them across, like, through the woods. They run down to, like, this overflowing river, and the little blonde girl's like, "You have to jump, Dorothy! You have to jump!" And the nurse, who is frankly terrifying, is like, "Come back, Dorothy!" And Dorothy's like, "Ah!" Jumps into the overflowing river, gets swept away, and then wakes up in a crib with the family chicken. Who knows how the chicken got there, but the chicken, who has never laid an egg or has stopped laying eggs, and can now suddenly talk, and they wash up on Oz, like on the shores of Oz, and everyone's dead. And that's where I'll leave it. It is notoriously dark, notoriously scary. I watched it in my 20s, and some parts were like, "Whoa, this is scary." Like, I didn't even get to the scary stuff. The stuff that I said is just the intro. That's like the lighter part of the movie. When Queen Mombi and the Weirdos show up, it's like, wow, this is hard. Even for 80s kid stuff, this is hardcore. So yeah, if you want to see, I do think it is a genuinely good movie. When you get to the ending and you get the happy ending, it feels very earned. But it is very, very weird and very dark. And yeah, I highly recommend watching it if you're not squeamish about scary stuff. No children are harmed. I will say that. Like, up front, no kids are harmed in this film. Yeah, it's just a scary movie. But yeah, that movie's wild. Anyway, well, enough about Return to Oz.
I think this stemmed from us talking about costume design, and I have no idea how we got here.
Yeah. Well, okay, real quick, what is one of your favorite costume projects that you've ever worked on?
Oh god, I mean, my most recent thing is, like, I keep saying, my favorite thing I've ever made, which was my final project for my master's degree in prosthetic effects.
It's
prosthetic
incredible.
Effects is usually, oh, thank you. Prosthetic effects is usually more like special effects makeup, prosthetic makeup kind of thing, but there is definitely like a relationship with kind of specialty costume and costume props and stuff like that, which they encouraged on the course. And I knew going in, like, I wanted to dabble with more like creatures and prosthetic stuff, but I also knew I wanted to, basically I knew they taught 3D modeling and I wanted to go more into doing armor and props for film. And being able to do 3D modeling, like, that is the current zeitgeist. So I was like, that's the main thing I want to get from this course. So for my final project, I decided I wanted to design and make a suit of armor. And I got to do basically a thing I've wanted to do forever, which was to create a fantasy costume design inspired by traditional Islamic armor.
Whoa.
And yeah, so that was like the origin point of the idea.
I can see it. Looking at it right now, I can see what you're talking about. Like, especially with the shape of the helmet.
Yeah, yeah. That was very much based on like the Turkish turban helmets, and the breastplate is also based on, it was sort of a mixture, it ended up being a bit of a mixture of like Turkish, Persian and Indian armor. But obviously, because I wasn't trying to do like a historical one-to-one recreation, I was kind of taking those design inspirations and melding them and then kind of iterating upon them and extrapolating from them to create something that was more fantasy. And yeah, like, that was something where I got full control over the design as well as the build, like from start to finish, and got to tap into an inspiration I've wanted to use for a really long time. And I loved like every second of it. And yeah, like 3D modeled the armor, hand weaved the chainmail, sewed the tunic. Sewing's not really my main thing, but I use it as like a sort of supplementary thing for armor most of the time. But yeah, that was the project where I really got to go in depth with both design and 3D modeling. And my tutors responded really well to it. And I found out the other day I got a distinction for that project. Hey.
Yeah.
Yay!
Yeah.
And you know,
that's so cool. I mean, well deserved.
Thank you.
Well deserved. Even just the colors, like ignoring the incredible work that was put into creating the dang thing, the colors are fantastic, like truly phenomenal.
Thank
it's
you.
Just, it's wonderful.
That's, yeah, I was gonna say, like, that's also one of my favorite color schemes is gold with like turquoise or light blues is underrated S tier color scheme.
Yeah, I mean, looking here, that's some serious S tier right there.
Oh, wow. So yeah, I think that's my favorite thing I've ever done.
Yeah. Do you think you would ever use that for like a character in anything?
I mean, I kind of have because there's a character. You mean in like a TTRPG sense, or
yeah?
So I mentioned earlier during 2020 and 2021, I played with a group called No Initiative doing an actual play, a quest actual play, mm-hmm. and in that I played a character called Faris who. The kind of origin point of her character was I want to play a character who's very aesthetically linked to like the sun and solar imagery. And that ended up being weaved into like the backstory and the location she was from that I created for the game.
Okay.
And of course being mixed like Swana and South Asian, we were talking earlier about like designing TTRPG characters. That's another thing that I find links into how I design TTRPG characters as well, is like it's a way for me to explore like my mixed heritage, whether that's creating a character who's got a mixed identity or exploring that concept, or whether it's kind of taking aspects of that and going like, I want to create a character inspired by this part of my heritage or whatever. And
for those who don't know, SWANA stands for Southwest Asian and North African.
Yes. Yeah.
Is that correct? Okay. Yeah. Please continue. Sorry, I didn't throw that out.
Sorry. Yeah, I should say the acronym. The yeah. Faris's design, like the armor she wore, was based on similar styles of armor. She didn't have a helmet, but she had that style of breastplate, kind of similar to like Mamluk armor and stuff, where it's plates joined by chainmail, and you have that very sort of iconic domed plate in the torso. And I actually like went back and looked at the character design I did for her when I was like sort of ideating for this project. And I actually did I not only designed my character for that, but I ended up doing our like character art for the stream for that. So I did like my character's art and everybody else's art as well, which was sort of another way in which like my artistic and design skills kind of came into play in TTRPGs, was I ended up doing like character art for streams I was in and stuff like that. So yeah, like she was very kind of like in that world as well. And to be honest, like a lot of my characters draw from those aspects of my heritage, because I feel like it's something that's very underserved in fantasy as a whole. And when it is done, it's usually white people co-opting it and doing it through like very stereotyped ideas of whether it's like Swana or South Asian.
It's always the welcome, my friend.
I know it's kind of bad for me to like lump it all in, but the welcome
in the back.
I know it's kind of bad for me to lump it all in, but I am mixed like South. I'm like mixed South Asian and West Asian and North African. So like, I'm not lumping it all in to be like that. It's like, that's my heritage, but people also lump it all in when they're creating like settings and stuff, and they make these very like non-specific.
Do you play Genshin Impact?
No, I don't. I know the drama around that issue though.
Yeah,
with Genshin Impact. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Because they earlier, was it this year, dropped like a whole setting that again lumps in Northern Africa and India. There's like all these like jungle areas and also all of these desert areas, and it's just, I mean, honestly, it is probably the coolest region that I've seen from that game. And the music absolutely slaps, but it does it does fall into that pitfall of just being like, yeah, it's all the same thing. And they just lumped it all in together.
I don't know anything about Genshin Impact. I've never played it. The most I knew about it was that like I follow Kamumi Cosplay on YouTube and she did cosplays from it. But I a while ago wrote a thread on the belly dancer outfit and kind of the issues with its origins as we know it now and why it's like problematic for it to be used even by like Eastern quote unquote developers. Like there's a lot of JRPGs where dancers are wearing belly dancer outfits and they're very sexualized and they're the sort of orientalized characters within those settings, even though it's a setting made by people from Asia. And we ended up doing an episode on Asians Represent, kind of going more in depth on that. But that thread, quite consistently, I find people like retweeting it and quote tweeting it into threads on the topic when a piece of media kind of does that, TM. And I noticed like it happening again at one point, like a year or two ago or something. And I kind of like clicked into the thread just to see what they were talking about. And it was people talking about Genshin Impact. And I was like, I don't go to this school. I don't know what Genshin Impact is or does, but I'm happy for you guys to use my thread to discuss this topic. And because, and then I like scrolled up and saw the character designs and I was like, oh yeah, that's super orientalist.
Yeah. Yeah, super. Yeah. I do suggest checking out the music. In fact, I'll send you a track because I've actually used it. Mm. One of the songs I've used in like when I do in-person games sometimes for Utarum games. Cause I'm like, this is really good. It's like really, really good music. But yeah.
Sometimes something can have a soundtrack that slaps, but the thing is racist.
Yeah.
Like, I was
basically
talking about The Road to El Dorado with someone the other day.
Oh,
and I was like, you know what? I watched that film when I was a kid and I really loved it. It is pretty problematic, but the songs though, they slap.
Yeah. It's you hate to see, like, sometimes it's like, I feel like this music deserved something that was a little bit better. Yeah. And that is a common problem. I know I'm a fan of Berserk, the manga specifically, and there's a whole, mm-hmm. it falls into the same pitfall, like where it has a culture that is clearly a mishmash of India and other, in like Southwest Asia and also Northern Africa, just bloop and sent in. And even though there are very cool characters who are part of that, like who are very interesting as people, it's just like, yeah, it kind of, I give it slightly more slack because it does the exact same thing to Europeans at least. So at least it's equal opportunity racist. But it is, yeah. it absolutely falls into the same traps, I think, of just like conflating a bunch of different.
It's like, cultures. But there's a power dynamic there.
Yeah,
you know.
True. Yeah, very true. Yeah. But
I do think it's quite funny though, when you see like, games developed by like Japanese companies or just like non-Western companies, but usually mm-hmm. it's Japanese, where they kind of do their version of that with Europe. I always think it's very funny. Like for example, Fire Emblem Fates, I'm not saying it's a great game, but I did play it. And it is very funny to me how, so like the premise is there's like two versions of the game, one where you are on one side of this war and one where you're on the other side. And one side is very like Japanese coded mm-hmm. and the other side is basically what Europe and America always do to Asia, to Europe. And it's like, this character has a French name, this character has an Italian name, this character has a German name, and they're all brother and sister. And everything is just this mishmash of like England, France, Germany, Italy, Spain. It's so funny to me.
It's also, I find it really interesting because it's like, oh yeah. Oh, that I see it now. I can see what you're doing there. Yeah, makes sense.
Yeah.
Just, yeah.
And, you know, when Pokemon does it with, like, France and Britain and America, I'm like, this is actually good and funny.
Yeah.
Because the power imbalance goes the other way, you know?
Yeah, I've never. Gen 5 was actually the last series of main series games I ever played, mostly because the Pokemon designs. But I remember just coming away from being like, you wanted to do a game based on America and that's the setting you made? Come on, like, what is there's so much more going on.
So I know that they were specifically with Black and White wanted it to be based on New York and the surrounding area of New York rather than the whole of America, because god, that would probably be way too big to do. But like, yeah, I actually love Black and White. I think they're really good, but it is quite funny.
The Unova city, the main city was really cool. I remember thinking that like the big central city was pretty awesome. Though before we close out here, there is one thing that we always have to bring up. We always have to ask our guests for a tale from the table. This can be a fun, this can be a scary, this can be a triumphant, this can be a sad story, something, a memorable moment that has occurred to you in and around a tabletop role-playing game.
Oh my god.
I can throw out examples. Okay, so Tale from the Table, I think I mentioned this already earlier this year, but ooh, okay, I got a Tale from the Table. This actually was a game that I did that was inspired by, because one of the players, I did this for D&D in a Castle, and one of the players, it was a Redwall style game. So very like anthropomorphic animals, but throwing out like the vermin stuff and then throwing out they all have to be like English animals. I threw all of that out and you could just be an animal from anywhere. Well, one of the players specifically, I had wanted to do like some kind of a European setting because I just never play in games that are inspired by like myself. Rather, I never run games really that are inspired by like European stuff usually. But one of the players requested something African. So I was like, I'll split the difference. And we did an Al-Andalus game.
Oh, cool.
So I did like a bunch of, and it was like, inspired by the Taifa period of Al-Andalus, which is like after a succession dispute occurred with a literal, in real life, a literal evil vizier who tried to overthrow the government, and a civil war erupted, including like a lost prince. It's a really interesting story. Mm-hmm. But all of the region basically got split up into these petty kingdoms, and no one felt comfortable calling themselves a king because they knew it would upset everybody else. So they all just sort of were like, I'm not really a king, but you know, I'm kind of like a king. And there was like a very uneasy power imbalance. And of course the Reconquista was happening at that point. That took a really long time anyway, but you have threats from the north. You have El Cid running around fighting for both sides, just being a chaos gremlin, an extremely skilled warrior chaos gremlin. And so we did like a game based on that. And part of it concerned a heist. They realized that this person that they suspected of being the bad guy was probably going to try and steal a major powerful magical item that was under lock and key. And so they created like this elaborate plan to try and steal this thing. It was a full heist. And they were like, they had two teams. One team was supposed to give a signal. After a certain amount of time, the other team would go. And it was like trying to create a diversion, trying to sneak into the place. There was climbing up and down chimneys. And the highlight was when I think they so in this world, I had the animals, since all the animals were people, I had the bugs become the animals. So there are like cow-sized beetles and stuff running around. And I think they cast in large on a beetle and had it run into the front of the building and complete like destroy the entire front of, it was like a huge religious house that it basically just crashed into, completely distracting the guards. Meanwhile, from the inside, like one of them, I think realized there were like invisible sensors all over the place. I don't even remember what all I did, but he literally carved off a section of the wall. Like he used magic to blow off a section of the wall that the item was attached to. And they like snuck it out that way. And it was there's no one specific moment. There's no one specific moment during the setting that was like the one moment, but the end of the session, one of the players who's like a forever DM was like, that was the best session of D&D I've ever played. And I was like, single tier. And then later it turns out that actually the item had already been stolen and they stole the fake. It was all for naught, but it was a really, really fun time. Anyway, that's my little tale from the table. Did that give you an opportunity to come up with one yourself?
Yeah, I've thought of one. I was like, I feel like I have so many, but one I feel like you and many of the kind of people who listen to your podcast will kind of go like, yeah, is the time I got to punch a capitalist like sack of shit in the face in the game, but it was even more satisfying than that. So the background of this was like, this is my character who is she's a bladesinger, rogue multiclass. But she, important to the story, she also has the metamagic adept.
Okay.
Her backstory involved her family having been exiled from the city that they are from, literally before she was born. So she has never like experienced being to that city before. And let's just say they know that there is some like political bullshit around their family being exiled. And that was something that I wanted to explore in her backstory. Through the course of the story, the family ended up having to go back to the city, basically because it was thought that my character's mother was dead, and she found out that her mother was not dead. She'd been trapped in the far plane for years and years, and they basically managed to like pull her out of the far plane. Not the far plane, sorry, the far realm. Far plane's from Final Fantasy X. God is a far realm, the far realm. She was trapped in the void.
Where all the aberrations come
from.
Yeah.
They had pulled her out of the far realm. And my character was like, oh my God, I assumed my entire life that my mother was dead. And now I get to know her, even though, you know, the last time she saw me, I was a baby. So, but her mother was the reason the family was exiled due to, a storm that was caused by an arcane focus that she owned, but did not realize was corrupted by an entity from the Far Realm. And in trying to sort of purify that vessel, she accidentally caused this storm that caused like huge damage to the city and stuff like that. Okay. But it was decided like, no, this is just entirely your fault kind of thing. And they were exiled. Or rather the family fled. And because they fled, they were like, well, if we can't catch you, you're in exile now. And basically people from the city found out that her mother was in fact alive now. And they kidnapped her and stole her back to the city to like put her on trial. And so my character and supporting characters and family all go back to the city to be like, no, actually, we're going to like defend her. And it is great. And through like that storyline, basically when my character arrives back in the city, she keeps having these weird things happen where someone tries to show up and like kidnap her or attack her. And at first people kind of assume it's like, well, there's people in the city who just hate your family because of what happened. And eventually she finds out that no, there's someone like pulling the strings behind this. Someone basically wants to stop my character from being able to, what's the word at a trial?
Object?
No, oh, that's like, at a wedding. Give her, I'm saying, like,
testify. Yeah. Testify. My
testify,
goodness.
Yeah. They want to stop her from being involved in and testifying in this trial because they know that what she has to say is probably going to like help her mother not be sent to prison or executed. Basically through this like massive story arc with lots of traumatizing things happening, they find out that there is this like capitalist pig called Viktor Rashnikov, who has in... It's a great name for a capitalist asshole. I think the DM based it on like the name of a real like oil baron or something. and he's this like tech billionaire inventor who claims to have built all these amazing things. And he is not from this city. And he has like set up shop in the city over the like in recent years, and basically has become like the dominant force in like the tech industry and military tech in the city. And she basically finds out that the reason he got his foothold in the city is because after her and her family fled the city, he stole and co-opted airship designs that her members of her family had created. They fled on an airship. And it was like a whole part of her backstory that she lived on an airship that her uncle had built. And that was why they were able to flee the city. I just love an airship, me.
This is a pro airship podcast.
So her uncle had built this airship and was in the process of trying to sort of get it patented in the city right before all this like disaster befell the family. And Viktor Rashnikov stole the design, claimed it as his own, and that was his foothold into starting his like that wing of his business in that city. And so basically he was trying desperately to get my character's mother convicted to murder my like other members of my character's family and to like kidnap her and keep her away from the trial and eventually kill her. All because he did not want the family to be able to come back to the city, because if the mother was found not guilty, then the exile would be lifted. He did not want that family to be able to come back to the city, because then they would find out and be able to argue against the fact that he was using their designs. And she uncovered this whole thing where it turned out he has this pattern of stealing other people's designs and claiming them as his own. He has people killed off if they ever find out about it. Or he just like kills them off and steals their designs. And she had to go through like all this anguish where the law enforcement of the city like just totally do not believe that she is someone who can be trusted. And in fact, he eventually constructs this plot to like make, he basically drops a bomb on part of the city.
No.
Yeah. Which is like technology that is like new in this world. He like fires a missile at part of the city and convinces the law enforcement through tech that he owns and has manipulated that it was her magic that caused this. And it's like, see, you can't trust this family. You can't trust them. So she's like being she's being hunted with a bounty on her head while having to investigate and find evidence to prove that he's actually the one who's been causing all these atrocities and is actually at the core of trying to meddle with this trial. And it turned into like this huge thing. And basically I knew it was building up to like, I want to like mess this guy up. I want to fuck him up. And she slash me basically like, this is great when you have a DM who's willing to like work with you to make what you want to happen happen. I was like, I want her to like publicly humiliate him to the point where he has to turn on her in public. And that's the thing that makes everyone go like, oh yes, it was him. And so she finds out he's going to be getting like a medal of commendation from the city for the reaction and response that his like military tech had in helping the city after the missile blew up part of the city. And she's like, oh my God, no, getting a medal for the atrocity you caused. Like, no. So she manages to like gather enough evidence to like basically accost him at the medal ceremony in public, where they can like use magic slash technology to throw up like footage on a screen in public and like hack into their system and be like, oh, you did this, you said this, you did this. And she like goads him, like eggs him on so much that he just like turns on her in public, attacks her, and then orders another missile strike on the city in public, and then tries to like fly away on an airship. She follows him onto the airship. They fight. My character's boyfriend, who's an NPC, who's her boyfriend, is also present for this fight. Rashnikov like knocks him down to zero, throws him off the side of the airship.
Oh no!
She like just in time casts Featherfall on him, and then it's like so much is happening.
Yeah.
And then she, like, I can tell he's like bloodied, like kind of low on health. I have her do her like Bladesinger attack combo on him. And the DM's like, he's looking like really, really bloodied, really bloodied. And I'm like, quicken spell, shocking grasp. But in this case, I cast shocking grasp by punching him in the face.
Yes.
And I rolled a crit on the shocking grasp.
What level were you?
And I knew, like, oh god, she's quite a high level character. I think at that point she's like level 17 or 16 or something like that. So like quite a high level.
Oh wow, with a crit, this is like 6 or 8 d8.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. And just that, like, I just wanted to like humiliate him in public and punch him in the face.
Yeah.
Like, that's what I wanted.
Oh, that's great.
It was great. And then, you know, we had to fly up into the sky and try to stop the missiles from hitting the city.
Of course.
So much drama. Yeah.
Wow.
But yeah, that was punching an evil tech billionaire in the face.
Was that the climax of the campaign?
Not.
That sounds like a campaign climax.
Not even the climax of the campaign. It's the climax of
my word.
Part of my character's backstory. This is also in, so this character is like, she's like my favorite, my favorite D&D character. And she was the character I played in the actual play where I had some bad racist experiences behind the scene. And one of the things that was always really sad to me, as well as just experiencing all those horrible things, was the fact that I cared so much about that character, and it felt like it kind of mired my feelings around that character, and that I didn't, and then also just like I didn't get to like play that out. So my boyfriend actually DMs this new version of the campaign for me, and we play like a one-on-one game together. We've like, because he does like pro GMing and stuff, and he was trying to convince me like one-on-one games are great, and I was like, really? Without a party? And then he convinced me to try one, and I was like, oh, this is amazing. Yeah, we get to just like go as in-depth as we want, and we don't have to like worry about it. It's great. And that gave me the ability to like rebuild that character and then have like a more positive experience with that character, where we can like construct the campaign ourselves and everything. And it's really nice.
Yeah, that's so nice.
So yeah.
What a nice
and
boyfriend.
And then she gets to punch evil capitalists in the face.
Yeah. Oh, that sounds wonderful. What a happy ending there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh.
Next up in the campaign, she's currently She's going to use a Wishblade to help people who are like, it's like a, you know, the horrible vampire family lording it over this particular area. This is, my boyfriend is like, this is me being like, these are like the two things from Curse of Strahd I think are worth doing in this campaign. So yeah, she's going to like help the villagers just fucking wreck these vampires, basically, with a Wishblade she stole from their castle.
Oh, adding insult to injury.
Yeah.
I love it. This sounds like a great campaign. I'm very happy for you that you get this quiz. It's fantastic. All right, Izza, thank you so much for giving so much of your time, but I want to let you go. Please let the people know where they can find you.
Well, thank you for having me on. This was a lot of fun. I'm sorry that we ended up just going another hour talking
no
about
no apologies
things.
Necessary. No apologies necessary. Yo, if you're listening to the main feed right now and you're wondering what just happened, we go listen to the Patreon and you will hear an extended version of this episode that involves discussions of Glee, Project Runway, America's Next Top Model, Tim Gunn and Andre going to Red Lobster, all sorts of fun things.
Trash TV.
Yes, the trash TV cut. Release the trash TV cut. Please. Where can the folks find you?
I'm Izza. You can find me on various social medias under the name Evil Clever Dog. I have a YouTube channel under that name, as well as Twitter, Instagram, and now Blue Sky. I refuse to call Twitter X, so Twitter. Yeah.
No one calls it X on here. In this house, we do not call Twitter X. We call Twitter Twitter.
No, absolutely not. Absolutely not. We will not acknowledge Elon Musk's bullshit.
No.
You can find me on all those social medias under the name Evil Clever Dog. I am a costume and prop designer and cosplayer and sometimes tweeter about TTRPGs, I guess, and various other things. If you'd like to see me rambling about Star Trek and reality TV and stuff like that, you can also go there and find that. And follow me and look at my cool work and stuff like
that. Go look at the suit of armor that Izza was talking about, because it is sick. It is absolutely sick.
Thank you.
I love the side-by-side on your Instagram that you do with your very first piece of armor that you ever made, which you talked about. I just realized was what you were talking about.
Yes, that was what I was talking about.
Yeah. It's, I mean, the original one was already pretty cool, but this is like, dang. I feel like if I saw that in a movie, I'd be like, whoa, that's really cool.
Yay! You hear that, people at these workshops hire me to make armor for you.
There you go. thank you so much, Izza. And the rest of you, you
thank
can...
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, go follow Izza, and then while you're at it, go check out the 3BH Patreon. I believe it's patreon.com/3blackhalflings or 3bhalflings, because we changed it recently. In fact, I'm going to look it up right now, because I don't usually do the Patreon plugs. I don't usually do the Patreon plugs these days. So let me see. Patreon.com. Yes. Patreon.com/3blackhalflings. It's the number 3blackhalflings. We rebranded the Patreon to match everything else. And go follow the show on Twitter, Instagram. I don't know if we're on Blue Sky yet. We probably should be. Facebook.
I feel like you're on Blue Sky. I feel like I remember.
I am. Yeah. Am I? Let me see. Yeah. Am I following you on Blue Sky? I feel like I am. I am following you on Blue Sky. Yeah, follow us on Blue Sky, everybody.
Validation.
I guess I should plug myself real quick. Yeah, you can follow me on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook. Well, don't follow me on Facebook. But you can find me on Twitter and Instagram and Blue Sky. Instagram, I'm at the Cobmeister, and Twitter and Blue Sky, I'm at Jeremy Cobb1. Cobb with 2 B's, the number 1. If you want to play D&D with me, come to D3 at Sea. Sign up for D3 at Sea. I'm doing it fall this year. We're going to be doing a cruise. Going to be playing Inutarum, the world of Outlaws and Obelisks and Slowdown Showdown. It's going to be a blast. What was the other thing I was going to say? There's another thing I was going to say. The thing I was going to say was, go check out Project Mirana, which is a Call of Cthulhu game that I'm in. And also, I don't know if it's going to continue, but I may also by this point be appearing semi-regularly on Dungeon Master's Block, which Neil from Dungeon Master's Block has been on before. He's a friend of the show. And actually, we were on Dungeon Master's Block years ago. So go check that out. So yeah, there's more plugs, but I'm done. thank you all so much for listening. And thank you once again, Izza. This was a blast. I hope you have...
Oh, thank you so much. This was so much fun.
Yes, I hope you have a wonderful day. And I look forward to the things that we've been planning that I won't go into details about.
me too.
Yes. So long, Shire folk. You can say it too if you want.
So long, Shire folk!
Yay!
That was a HeadGum Podcast.